From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, what the increase in a minimum wage could mean for Texas. Governor Rick Perry takes a stand against Medicaid expansion at CPAC. And is Harris County more likely to send a defendant to death row if they are black? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. During President Obama's last State of the Union address, he proposed raising the national minimum wage to $9 an hour and permanently indexing it to the cost of living. Supporters say it's a way to redistribute income from thriving corporations to workers. Others say it's a sure way to kill jobs. Texas would be the state most impacted if the wage increase becomes law. We have the most minimum wage workers in the nation. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 1.7 million Americans earned the federal minimum wage in 2011. 61% of them were female, a quarter of them worked in the food industry, and another quarter worked in retail. And 40% of them are black or Latino. Ida Sima Cavazos is a San Antonio home healthcare worker who makes more than the $7.25 minimum wage.
Started at $8 an hour, and after 3 years, I got a raise to $8.50 an hour.
Cavazos says trying to live off her current pay is a struggle where there's no end in sight.
I can only tell you that we're living under such harsh circumstances. Those people that work for the minimum wage and such low wages, that in essence it's like slavery, because these are poverty wages. And no matter how hard you work, you're getting paid poverty wages. So what do you end up with? You're still in poverty. You cannot work your way out of poverty receiving poverty wages. So it's very limited, you know. You have to space out everything. And my light bill is late, so I send a partial payment. My water bill is late, so I send a partial payment. Because you're trying to catch up all the time, trying to catch up, because you don't have it. And my home. I would love to invest in my home. There's some repairs that need to be done, but I have to turn a blind eye to it because I can't afford to make those repairs. So that's the type of life we're living.
And she says a pay increase to $9 an hour would make a big difference in her life.
Well, I would assume that it would help. Some make a calculation of it being $75 every 2 weeks. Well, I see that as $150 a month. What could I do with $150 a month? Well, to me, that means I could pay my water bill. And maybe I could buy a pair of pants for my son. It won't be the latest fashions and the brands that they are. But, I can budget something. Maybe some fresh vegetables for the table. So, yes, it means a lot. And it's a start. It's better than what we've gotten.
That was Ida Sima Cavazos, a San Antonio home healthcare worker, talking about why she's supporting an increase for the minimum wage to $9 an hour. Many economists say a minimum wage increase would be a positive boost for the national economy, since people like Cavazos would immediately spend their additional income on consumer items, drive up demand, and create more jobs. But economists like Professor Jonathan Meir at Texas A&M argues raising the minimum wage would reduce job creation.
What we found was that a higher minimum wage causes slower job growth. And the real innovation of our paper was that we examined job creation and job destruction separately, rather than just looking at the level of employment. So what we found was that it's not that people get fired when the minimum wage goes up, but fewer new jobs are created. So there are people who just never get on the job ladder. They never get that initial experience. One of the other interesting things about the minimum wage is that almost two-thirds of people who earn the minimum wage in 1 year earn more the following year, usually on average about $1 an hour more. So most minimum wage jobs are held by relatively young people who are just getting their start out. They're entry-level jobs, but if you put those entry-level jobs out of reach, then those people never get on that job ladder.
So by raising the minimum wage, you're creating a barrier for entry-level employment.
Yes, I think that'd be an accurate way to state it, that it's a barrier to entry-level employment. It makes it harder for people to get that first job that gets them that line on the resume to try to get work experience, a letter of recommendation, and so on for better jobs.
Is there a smarter way to try to accomplish what the proponents of a minimum wage increase want, which I guess is to get more money in the pockets of our low earners?
Yes. So, and I should say that the people who are calling for increases in the minimum wage are, for the most part, very well-intentioned people who have a noble goal, which is to help low-income people, particularly low-income families. One important thing to know about the minimum wage is only about 15% of minimum wage earners are heads of household with children. More than half of minimum wage earners are 25 years old or younger, and about a quarter of them are high school or college students. So if what you want to do is target low-income families, we have the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is at this point the largest anti-poverty program in the country run at the federal level. It's over $60 billion a year, and that's very targeted to working families, particularly those with two or three or more children. And that's going to get you a much more targeted approach to trying to help those people get more money in their pockets so they have a better standard of living.
So when people pay their taxes, they get a credit, so they're able to actually have more money at the end of the year.
Yes, and at this point, I believe this coming year, the maximum credit, which is refundable, is going to be about $6,000 for a family with three or more children. Who's earning at the peak subsidy amount. For a large part of the distribution, this is about a 40 to 45% subsidy on their wages. So when you're thinking about someone who is actually a working parent, for example, with say two children, for a large part of their earnings, you've got about a 40% subsidy, which, you know, off say $10 an hour would really make it equivalent to being $14 an hour.
So do you think we should eliminate the minimum wage altogether?
I believe we should. I think, and I know that sounds a little shocking, but what ends up happening is that the market will take care of an equilibrium wage. Employers, of course, would like to pay their employees as little as possible, but employees won't accept those wages. And the fact is there's a lot of competition for these very low-skilled jobs. Restaurants need employees both in the front of the house and the back of the house. You know, people need staff. And so the competition among these employers of low-skill labor is going to move the wage. My guess, and this is, to be honest, just a guess, is it's going to be somewhere not too far off of the current minimum wage of $7.25. But Congress can no more legislate away the laws of supply and demand than it can legislate away the laws of gravity. So just telling an employer you have to pay people $10 or $12 or why not $50 an hour doesn't mean that the employer is going to hire someone. The real minimum wage is zero.
Jonathan Meir is a professor of economics at Texas A&M University at College Station. He authored a study that says an increase in the national minimum wage would create a barrier for new employment. Many of the nation's most conservative voices are in Washington, D.C. this weekend for CPAC, including Texas Governor Rick Perry. Perry was invited to speak, and in his remarks, he said the reason the GOP is losing presidential elections is because of their nominees, like Senator John McCain and Mitt Romney, were too moderate.
Now, the popular media narrative is that this country has shifted away from conservative ideals, as evidenced by the last two presidential elections. That's what they think. That's what they say. That might be true if Republicans had actually nominated conservative candidates in 2008 and 2012. Might be true.
Perry's appearance at CPAC is refueling talk of another presidential run for the Texas governor. Also in his speech, Perry essentially doubled down on his refusal to expand Medicaid in Texas.
The Medicaid expansion amounts to one large incremental step towards single-payer socialized medicine. That's where we're headed. And I, for one, will not accept that as long as I am the governor of the state of Texas.
Perry's refusal to expand Medicaid in Texas is seen by some as a possible spark that could ignite a Democratic Party grassroots movement in the state. And the National Democratic Party is looking to accelerate turning Texas into a two-party state with a project called Battleground Texas. At the center of the effort is Jeremy Byrd, a former national field director for President Barack Obama's reelection campaign.
Well, Texans are doing it on their own. And in fact, Battleground Texas is
run by the grassroots folks in Texas, the volunteers, 300-plus that came out in San Antonio the other night, the 300-plus in Austin. Those volunteers are the backbone of Battleground Texas, and they're going to be driving this all across the state. They are the ones who, you know, for many years have been making volunteer calls into other states that are considered battleground states. And our goal and the purpose of Battleground Texas is to encourage those folks to give them the tools and the training and the resources out there in order to be able to have their voices heard so that we can expand the electorate in Texas and increase the turnout.
So year after year, no Democrats being elected to statewide office in Texas. Right now, none are elected to statewide office in Texas. Why aren't Texan voters buying what Democrats are selling?
Well, the first problem is we're not talking about all Texans. We're talking about 50% of the population who's turning out in elections. So what we're getting in Austin and the delegation that is going to Washington from Texas is a government by half the people for half the people. And, you know, with 2 million plus unregistered voters and many voters not turning out to vote, that's what's caused what we see now with the government in Austin and what we see now with the government and the folks that are going to D.C. So it's not that the voters aren't buying what's out there. It's that not enough folks are participating in the process. And unfortunately, for too long, that's created a cycle where there hasn't been as competitive statewide races as there should be, given the diversity of the state, given you know, where the voters in Texas stand on issues. They're not in line with Rick Perry and what he's pushing at the Capitol. And the question is, can we encourage folks to get registered and have their voices heard in the way that it should be?
I've heard it said that there just really isn't enough grassroots out there for Democrats, that they're not able to get good candidates to create the grassroots, and the grassroots aren't there to help the good candidates get elected. So you got a chicken and egg situation.
Well, the grassroots are incredibly strong in Texas, actually. And, you know, you could look at the huge crowd in San Antonio for our kickoff Battleground Texas event on Sunday, the huge crowd in Austin on Monday night, and what you see is grassroots folks who are ready, who have been, who are tired of what they're seeing from the Republicans in Austin, and they want to change that. And so I think I've seen energy across the state that's rivaled anything I've seen in politics, and I think those folks are ready to do what it takes to run a grassroots movement across the state to increase the voter registration rolls and to turn folks out, to show that elections matter and really impact people's lives.
Well, I've seen huge crowds at the strangest events, people calling for Texas secession. I mean, that's not what you base the strength of a political movement on, is, you know, the size of a one crowd. Barack Obama got 41% of the vote in his reelection for the state. You're wondering, where are the voters? Why aren't they turning out if they're buying what the Democrats are offering?
Well, if you look at 2008, for example, where you have the best data, because there was exit polling in Texas in 2008, 54% of Latinos in the state were registered and 35% turned out. And those who did turned out in favor of the president in 2008. But what we have to do is go out and actually ask for voters' votes. You look at states like Colorado and Nevada and Florida, the participation rates are incredibly high. The participation rate in Texas is 48th in the nation in terms of turnout. The way to change that is for folks to go out and actually ask for voters' votes and to talk to them about the importance of elections. And that's what we're going to do. And it's not about people turning out at one event, but it's about people willing to go out there and work for it, precinct by precinct, to talk to voters, to put a clipboard in front of their face and register them, to bring them into the democratic process. And that's exactly what Battleground Texas is designed to do. And that's what we plan to do over the next several years.
Well, what about the issues that could resonate with the people that would vote for the Democratic Party, like Medicaid expansion in Texas, how that's kind of hit a wall in Austin, the budget cuts to education across the state in the last legislative session didn't seem to result in much of a change in the voting outcomes.
Well, if you look at what's happening from Governor Perry and the Republican legislature, they're not in line with Texas voters. If you do polling in the state and you talk to people, should Texas take billions of dollars that would help the Texas economy, strengthen the Texas economy, at the same time bring health care to many, many people across the state who don't currently have it? they're supportive of that. They're not supportive of the cuts to education. And the problem has been that what's been happening with the legislature hasn't been getting out to voters across the state. And what we plan to do is both through digital social media technology as well as boots on the ground, door to door, to shine a light on what's actually happening so voters can see the clear distinction and can make a choice. And that's what we need to do because they're not in line with what we're seeing and the extremism that we're seeing from the governor and the Republicans in Austin.
Jeremy Bird is the leader of Battleground Texas, an effort to organize state Democrats and turn Texas into a two-party state. Lawyers for death row inmate Dwayne Buck are seeking a new sentencing for the convicted murderer. Buck's attorneys say he was unfairly sentenced to death after testimony suggested that he was more likely to be dangerous because he is black. In addition, new research shows that Harris County District Attorney's Office is three times more likely to seek the death penalty for African Americans, which illustrates an institutional racial bias against defendants like Buck. Christina Swarns is the director of the Criminal Justice Project at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
That appeal asks for a new, fair sentencing hearing for Mr. Buck, one that is untainted by evidence of reliance on improper racial stereotype and appeals to fear based on race. We presented evidence that the state of Texas had promised Mr. Buck a new, fair sentencing and then has gone back on his promise. And we've also presented evidence showing that the use of race in Mr. Buck's case was not anomalous. We had a researcher analyze Harris County capital cases, and he found that for offenders who have case characteristics similar to Dwayne Buck's, the Harris County District Attorney's Office was three times more likely to seek the death penalty for African-American defendants as opposed to similarly situated white defendants, and that Harris County juries were twice as likely to impose the death penalty on African-American offenders than on similarly situated white offenders. Based on both of those facts, the case-specific evidence of the reliance on race in Mr. Buck's case, as well as the statistical evidence, as well as history of racial disproportionality and racial discrimination and the use of the death penalty in Harris County, we have asked for a new fair sentencing hearing for Mr. Buck.
Now, Mr. Buck, his case has already gone to the U.S. Supreme Court.
It has.
And they didn't see anything wrong with it.
Well, they didn't say that. They didn't accept his case for review when it went up on appeal. Two Supreme Court justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Elena Kagan, took the unusual step of writing explicitly about their concerns in Mr. Buck's case. They made clear that there were grave concerns about the state's use of race in Mr. Buck's capital trial, and they went further and said that there were grave concerns about whether the state had been honest with respect to whether or not it had promised Mr. Buck a new sentencing hearing during the federal court proceedings. Two Supreme Court justices have expressed grave concerns about Mr. Buck's case and the role of race in it.
The majority of the Supreme Court said that they weren't going to take this case because it was the defense attorney that brought in the expert who said that African Americans were more likely to be violent.
That's what two other justices wrote in explaining the Supreme Court's decision.
The defense attorney was Jerry Garineau.
It was. Jerry Garineau was Mr. Buck's trial counsel. There has been a fair amount of attention focused on Mr. Garineau's record in terms of his representation of capitally charged folks in Harris County. He has, I think the New York Times noted that he had represented more people who were on death row than many states had on death row in total.
20 people.
Yes, he has not had a very successful record of capital defense representation.
He says, I'm not a public defender. I am a lawyer who takes court-appointed cases.
I don't know what the difference is. I think if you, all of us that represent people who face the death penalty, who face capital charges, have an ethical obligation and a duty to represent our clients zealously and to the, to the full extent of our abilities and within the limits of the law. We know that he knew, and the state knew, that we all know that racial discrimination and appeals to racial bias are inappropriate bases upon which to sentence someone to death, period. He doesn't have to be a public defender to know that. He doesn't have to be he can be a court appointed. He still should know that. That is something someone without a law degree would know. So the fact that he was appointed counsel means nothing to the question of whether or not this evidence should have gone in under his watch at Mr. Buck's trial.
All right. Mr. Buck, he was on trial for murder.
He was on trial for murder.
What are the facts of the case?
Yeah, Mr. Buck has been convicted of killing two people, his girlfriend at the time, a woman by the name of Deborah Gardner, and another gentleman by the name of Kenneth Freeman. Mr. Buck has not and does not dispute, this appeal does not raise a question of whether or not Mr. Buck is innocent of those offenses, and I can tell you that Mr. Buck is deeply remorseful for his involvement in those offenses. That the question of whether or not he committed these crimes, isn't an issue in the case at this moment. And even if he did commit the crimes, the state still does not have the ability to enter evidence suggesting he should be sentenced to death because he is black.
He didn't get the defense that he deserved.
He most certainly did not.
To try and avoid getting the death penalty.
That is an understatement. That's correct. He did not get what the Constitution requires. He did not get what the American Bar Association guidelines for the representation of people charged or convicted of capital murder are entitled to. He didn't get what the State Bar of Texas requires that he receive. He didn't get the kind of counsel that anybody would want or hope or expect that people in this country facing the death penalty should receive.
Christina Swarns is the director of the Criminal Justice Project at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She has filed an application for appeal for the death sentencing of Duane Buck on the grounds that there was racial bias against him. Austin is being swarmed with creative types for the South by Southwest Film Festival. The winner of the Lewis Black Lone Star Award honoring Texas-based films was Loves Her Gun, the story of a young woman who moves to Texas after being mugged and beaten in a New York street. She finds peace and a sense of security when she gets a gun, but is it a false sense of security? The film is asking a lot of questions about guns, our love for them, our fear of them, and can we find the appropriate balance? Treist Kelly Dunn is the star of the film, and she spoke to Texas Public Radio's Nathan Cohn.
I think it's just being fed up with feeling not safe and feeling like at any moment it could happen again. I don't think she goes into it thinking, oh, I'm going to buy a gun for self-defense reasons, but she goes in, she goes to the shooting range with Melissa's character. And I think the thing about guns is they are seductive. They appeal to our imaginations. It's not like, I mean, when I came into the process of shooting this film, I was much more terrified of guns than I am now. And I, being from New York, I was like, I seriously didn't believe that, like, people just, like, had guns, and it was such a big part of their life. Because you just kind of, I'm from Utah, I didn't grow up around them, and then I live in New York, in New York City, where I don't know, I don't have friends who keep guns in their house. Like, I just don't know that. But when we started, making the film here, it's so much a part of the culture here that it's less scary, to me now, because it's demystified for me now. But I think it's like she goes into it just, okay, why don't I try this, And eventually she decides to buy a gun. Like, things happen, she's still afraid, and she sees, it's just the event is haunting her. So I think she gets wrapped up in this idea that if she has a gun, she'll feel safer. But how long has she been doing this? Is she qualified to use this? Is she, is she reasonable? Like, is she a person that should have a gun right now?
Well, that's a good question, because when you say, is she reasonable? I mean, she acts out in a couple of ways in the film, right, that I think most people would say are not reasonable at all.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is she wants to get something back. She wants to get something back that she lost. I think when I've never been attacked like that, but I've definitely felt bullied. I definitely felt taken advantage of. And the first thing that you feel is hurt, and then you feel pissed off, and then you feel like you want revenge. So in a way, I think what happens is she gets seduced by guns. She gets seduced by it. It makes her feel powerful. She loses her sense of who she was before the event that happened, and she decides, she decides to buy a weapon, and then she uses that in a way to get revenge.
What did the director, Jeff Marslet, tell you about this role and about guns in general when he was going into the picture?
What did we talk about? I don't know. He sent me an outline, and I read it, and I was really, really excited by it because I just thought, this is so, like, it would be really fun. It's such a circumstance-driven character, you know? It's not like, I wouldn't even call it, it is character-driven, I guess, but it's really circumstance-driven. It's like this person, all this stuff happens to her. So it's not like just who she is in life. It's who she is dealing with these circumstances. We talked about guns, but not really that much because it was more just like, oh, cool, we'll deal with it when we get there. I mean, I'd never really shot a gun before. And my stepmom, incidentally, she was a shotgun instructor. Before I came to Texas to shoot the movie, I was like I asked her if she would take me out to the range and, like, we could just shoot, you know, shotguns. And I was really, really scared at first. And then I got really comfortable with it. And then
How did you feel then when you got comfortable with it?
Well, it was fun. Like, it is fun. Shooting guns is fun. You know, it's like I first saw her get the gun out of the case, and I was like, oh, my God, this is terrifying. And we had to go through, like, an hour of, like, safety stuff, and I was like, I can't believe it. And then there's other people there just walking around with guns. I mean, I was like, this just feels wrong to me. This feels – because it's just something I'm not used to. But everybody's so comfortable with it. So I guess that made me more comfortable with it, to see that it was, like, a sport as well. It's not just, like, a bunch of crazies, you know? Not that I thought that before. It's just that I hadn't been exposed to any kind of, like, culture. So, yeah, it was interesting. We shot Trap, and it was really fun. And it's a really satisfying feeling, I guess. And it does make you feel powerful. It does make you feel cool. I think there are valid reasons for and against, you know, this gun issue. But I do think it appeals to people's sense of cool. And, like, all the cool guys in the movies do it. And I think it's sometimes less about, like, I need this for my safety, and maybe more about, this makes me feel really powerful.
It does look cool in the movies, you know, to have guns. And with increasing media coverage of shootings around the country, and with Sandy Hook, there's been this renewed call on Hollywood to lower the gun quotient, I suppose, in films.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Yeah, it's so interesting because I recently listened to something about, like, Japan, and they actually have more violent video game sales in Japan, but because guns aren't legal, they have obviously less mass shootings and less shootings in general. It's weird. It's like, is it the movies or is it the guns? Obviously the guns, because the guns are doing it. But why are we so obsessed with it? I guess that's maybe the question. It's like, why are we so obsessed with violence? Why are there things that we just... It's like the first game you play as a kid is Cops and Robbers. And, like, what is that? Like, you know, I mean, it's. I guess it is a lot from movies, you know, and growing up with this imaginative thing about being, like, John Wayne or being, like, a cop or... I don't know. It's interesting and it's fascinating to me, and I don't know where I stand on the issue all the time, because it's like I'm around certain people who are very responsible, and they're very responsible gun owners, and I'm like, oh, great. Like, why? It's just so much a part of their life. I wouldn't want to take that part of their life away from them. And then, you know, you meet other people, and you're like, it doesn't feel right to just give everybody just free access to these really powerful weapons.
Treist Kelly Dunn is the star of the film Loves Her Gun, which won the Lewis Black Lone Star Award at the South by Southwest Film Festival this week. She spoke to Texas Public Radio's Nathan Cohn. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. If you'd like to hear what you think about our show, you can send an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, or you can go to our website and comment right there at tpr.org. There are also past Texas Matters programs there you can listen to, and we are available on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.